You're listening to Opus Talks, where you'll be in on conversations with insiders in the energy, chemicals, and environmental commodities markets. Guests share insights into the latest trends and innovations, industry challenges, and much more. Let's dive into the conversations that explore where the energy economy is headed, right here on Opus Talks.
Hi, you're listening to Opus Talks Renewable Fuels. I'm Jordan Godwin, Director of Renewables Pricing and News here at Opus, a Dow Jones company. With me today is Fred Gatala, who recently took over the reins as President of Advanced Biofuels Canada, taking over for the legendary Ian Thompson, who served in the role since the organization was founded in 2005. Fred, how you doing, my friend? Would you mind telling us a little bit about yourself and your organization?
Good to see you, Jordan. Ian is indeed legendary. He's in the role of past president, so they haven't given me too long of a baton. Anyway, but the baton is in both of our hands. As of Jan 1, I am the president of ABFC, Advanced Biofuels Canada Association. I've been in the sector about 20 years almost, which is what a dynamic sector the biofuel space is, now more than ever, but it's kind of always been quite dynamic. So we are about a 30 plus member industry association. We cover Canada, federal and provincially. And as I think many of your listeners know, we've got a pretty active policy space in Canada. Of course, it's active like on the trade file now between Canada and the US, but we've got a lot of different provincial programs. We've got new federal programs. So as Advanced Biofuels Canada Association, ABFC is the acronym, we engage with governments at the provincial and federal levels to try to get in place strong, durable policies that make producing low carbon fuels in Canada a good business, help reduce emissions, help reduce consumer costs at the pump, and try to increase now energy security through the fuels that we produce and provide to, whether it's renewable diesel, biodiesel into the distillate fuel pool, sustainable aviation fuel into the jet kerosene pool, or bioethanol and co-processed gasoline, et cetera, into the gasoline pool. If it runs on fuels, we want more renewables in it. That's what we do day in, day out.
ABFC in a nutshell. Thank you, Fred, and congratulations on the new role as president. Fred will actually be speaking at our upcoming Opus Canadian Carbon and Biofuels Forum in Vancouver from May 20 to 21st. And it's the first time we're doing this event, and we're all really excited about it. And one thing that's for certain is that we'll have plenty to discuss. And I'm hoping Fred can give us a little sneak peek at the bigger themes we're going to look out for as what we'll be kind of covering in this podcast. So first off, Fred, I want to talk a little bit about Canada's clean fuel regulations, commonly known as the CFR, which started in 2023. We're a couple of years into that program now. How would you say it's going so far?
Oh, Jordan, it started in 2022. Come on, where you been? And it took 6 years to get in place. But yeah, it started June 2022. 2022 was a bit of a stub year. It wasn't a full year. So 2023 was the first full compliance year. It's a big policy, but probably the litmus test for how it's working is the CFR causing more biofuel demand than the sum of provincial policies? And the answer is yes. With the CFR in place, there's more renewable fuels being used across Canada than the sum of the provincial mandates. Of course, we've got a low carbon fuel standard in British Columbia, which is pulling renewables and diesel blend rates, you know, nearly 30%. The regulatory minimum is 4% renewables and diesel by volume. We've got a CI signal. So there's obviously things happening with a compliance credit market that are pulling in more fuels, but having the CFR, the clean fuel regulations on top of that is driving more demand. So that's, you know, like headlines, very positive. Talk to anyone in a fuel supplier or obligated parties compliance department, and they will tell you the CFR is quite a complex reg. It's got a lot of compliance deadlines that are hitting us right now. I mean, Q1 is the busiest quarter in the renewable fuel space. We've got a lot of deadlines that are end of April for our land use and biodiversity criteria that all require third-party verification. So it's a very busy reg. But take five steps back, and we've got a nationwide low carbon fuel standard in Canada. It is open to all manner of renewable fuels, no caps on food or feed crops like they've got in the recast RED in Europe. So we've got a very modern policy. It's got the plumbing in it to eventually include the jet fuel pool inside of the compliance obligation. The CFR has an opportunity for oil and gas refiners to generate credits through co-processing, through refinery improvements, through CCS in the upstream oil and gas sector. So there's a little bit in it for everyone. We could do a whole podcast on what's actually the different components of the CFR, but let's just say you can get credits by putting in place electric vehicle charging, low carbon renewable fuels, upstream oil and gas emission reductions. There's a lot of pieces to like, and it's something that can have the dial turned up on it as we get more low carbon fuels into the market and as more market participants start to get in the market and start selling fuel.
Yeah, very, very good summary of the program and where we're at with it so far. I was doing a little prep work for this podcast, and I was reading an interview that Ian did with our friends at Stillwater in May 2023. So a couple of years ago, and he called the CFR at the time too big to fail or too big to pull apart regulation. Given the current political climate in Canada, does it still feel that secure, I guess, 2 years later? Can you maybe walk us through the current Canadian political landscape at the moment and if there's been any conversation around, you know, trying to axe the tax, I guess, as they've said?
The tax has been axed. As of April 1st, we have no more consumer carbon price in Canada. It's down to zero. We still have the enabling statute in place, but the rates are effectively zero. So we had about 20 cents Canadian per liter on the diesel pool. That's gone. Had about 17 cents on the gasoline pool. That's gone. About 20 cents for intra-provincial jet fuel, which means basically flights within provinces, that's gone. So the carbon price and affordability, and the carbon price is a big part of fuel's affordability and just generally the affordability crisis, which was the ballot box question coming into this election, that's really fundamentally changed with the trade relationship being front of mind in the electorate. So I don't think anything's too big to fail. I mean, you could say the global trading system is too big to fail, but we're obviously in a very dynamic situation where that's being reshaped. Maybe I'll just add on to Ian's words a bit that the CFR has too big of a supporting cast of industries to have its legs cut out from under it without some serious repercussions. I mean, you've been in the sector a while. It's very rare that you have a single reg and you look to your left and you look to your right and you've got farmers lined up with biofuel associations, even lined up with refiners that all support the regulation, as well as with the electric vehicle community, the electric vehicle charging community, and a certain amount of environmental NGO support, because the CFR has a lot of these different aspects. They took a long time to develop it, 6 years, right? But they took their time to put in the pieces that would let it be supportable by a pretty big tent. So I think it's got a lot of reason to stay. There's not necessarily any broad groups pushing against the CFR. The biggest opposition to the CFR really comes from some outdated numbers around the cost that it's adding per liter of fuel. Remove the carbon tax and fuel's affordability really changes. And with that used to be the number one ballot box question, now it's far down the list. So we used to talk about net zero emissions when we talked about low carbon fuels and when we talked about pathways to decarbonization. Now we're really talking about net zero cost for these policies. We're subscribers, and I should probably note that Opus is a member of Advanced Biofuels Canada, and we see the numbers. We see how renewable fuels are saving consumers at the pump, especially bioethanol, right? And then you combine those with renewable diesel and biodiesel. Of course, the prices for both of those are coming down that reflect the lower input commodity prices. And you've got a pretty good argument for keeping this policy in place. And that's before we even start talking about energy security. I mean, the clean fuel sector is globally so big now that it is, you can't just remove it without having prices go up. So the narrative that we are increasingly hearing and helping put out is that clean energy is energy security. So that's what we're working on. That's what's happening. That's what it looks like. The dialogue is shaping up to be on the CFR, which is, this is something that is working. It's complex. We're really in the first compliance year where you have some of these more administratively challenging aspects, which are third-party verification, but we're all getting through it.
Yeah, that's great news then. And it sounds like the taking care of the carbon tax, like you mentioned, maybe gave a little more security to the CFR, and maybe it doesn't have as big of a target on its back.
Bingo. Remember that what the lexicon was, the carbon tax and the CFR being the second carbon tax. We have heard that far less. We have heard that far less. The carbon tax or the carbon levy under the Greenhouse Gas Pollution Pricing Act, when that was brought about, the dollars per ton were very small. The cents per liter were very small. As we get up to $80 a ton, those are real numbers that you're paying at the pump. The classic anecdote is that Canadians will cross the street for a penny savings at the pump. Very true. I mean, that is economically rational to do. You know, if you're able to reduce emissions, if you're able to create a domestic, durable, renewable fuel sector that really is not adding cost at the pump and is providing all of these ancillary benefits, it makes a lot of sense to keep around, especially as investments have been made on the back of it. Just so you know, like the carbon price federally, most households got more back than they paid in the carbon price through a rebate check. But it just is like, it's the perception. It is, I pay at the pump and then I get a check back later. It doesn't compute. It wasn't really connecting with the electorate. And so really not surprised at all that it's basically been jettisoned from all provinces. Quebec still has a cap and trade program right now. But as of last week, which was the last week of March, provinces are dropping it. Saskatchewan even removed their industrial carbon pricing system. So the landscape is changing, but renewable fuels still remain a very viable way for governments to reduce emissions and create value domestically, especially in rural economies.
Absolutely. Well said. Speaking of taxes and tariffs and whatnot, we've had quite a bit of noise over the past few months about the shifting trade policies on the U.S. side under the Trump administration, and some pushback from the Canadian side as well. While it's all still very new and constantly developing, what do you think may be the biggest impact of the tariffs and the escalating trade war, and how might U.S. and Canada biofuels be affected?
Right now on the Canadian counter tariff list, which is the one that we follow both of them, but the Canadian counter tariff list that was on the $60 billion of goods did not include biofuels. So we import, so much U.S. ethanol. That's a big part of our energy mix. There was, our list did not include bioethanol. What we continuously bring up when the discussion is about tariffs is that the issues of Canadian competitiveness with U.S. produced renewable fuels predates the Trump administration. The Inflation Reduction Act, from August 2022, this has been coming at us for 32 months now. The shift from a blender's tax credit, which Canadian producers of biodiesel and renewable diesel were able to receive when their fuels were exported to the US, that's completely changed under the PTC. When we all read the Inflation Reduction Act, there was a lot of obvious excitement around it. But then we quickly got to section 13704 that adds 45Z to the U.S. Internal Revenue Code. And that is an exportable production tax credit. And it's an exportable production tax credit that is linked to the emission rate or carbon intensity of a fuel. So we only had the 45 CF GREET come out the first couple of weeks of January. So we really didn't even know what the calculated rates were going to be on U.S. fuels. Very difficult for governments to design tax credits that respond to another government's tax credits that relate to a carbon intensity model that has just been released. And as soon as the model was released, our Parliament basically was prorogued, which means that Parliament was not sitting because the Liberals were undergoing a leadership race to determine that Mark Carney would be the new Liberal Prime Minister, who has now called an election for the end of the month. But the credit landed. It's real. It is in the market, even though there's some uncertainty over exactly how it's going to be accessed. The credit is in the market. So our producers are at a disadvantage by the amount of that credit. We see the RIN prices going up to, you know, signal adjustment to a post-BTC world. But regardless, our producers are underwater versus U.S. renewable fuel imports, which is why we've got a trade case. The Tidewater Renewables filed their trade case the last week of December that relates to the BTC. That renewable diesel coming in from the U.S. with the BTC and other tax credits embedded in it and incentives are undercutting the ability of domestic Canadian RD producers to supply their own market. That's currently underway. That review in March, a preliminary ruling was released by the Canadian Border Services Agency that basically stated there was the case for a trade investigation. The investigation is ongoing. A few of your listeners that supply renewable fuels to Canada probably got very lengthy RFIs to provide input to the CBSA and the Canadian International Trade Tribunal. So that's very much underway. So 45Z plus a trade case, and I haven't even started talking about tariffs yet.
Yeah, there's a whole lot going on. And I was also going to ask you about the British Columbia had a recent announcement that under the LCFS program, I guess the minimum renewable fuel blending requirements will need to be met using renewable fuels only produced in Canada. Can you tell us a little bit more about that shift and maybe how it's been received by your members in the industry?
Yeah, that's a big one. So February 27th, the government of BC announced that effective immediately, like you just said, I'll just repeat what you said, that the minimum requirement in diesel went from 4 to 8%. Gasoline stays at 5. I'll just double click on that for a second, because the reg in BC has a renewable fuel component and a low carbon fuel component in the same reg. It's very useful in that regard that it can set a minimum volume requirement and establish overall carbon intensity reduction requirement. So that gives them a bit more flexibility to do things within a single regulation than other LCFSs do. So yeah, what they did, they doubled the minimum volume on the diesel pool. We're already nearly at 30% blending in diesel. So this is a part of that market that is reserved for made in Canada production. Our estimates are that that's about a, you know, 315 million liter per year market that is for domestic producers only. Just under that for gasoline, because the gasoline minimum requirements of 5% were not changed, even though we're nearly at 10% renewables in gasoline, and that's bioethanol plus co-processed renewable gasoline plus a bit of bio-naphtha. So that creates a signal. It creates a signal for Western Canadian biodiesel and renewable diesel to access the BC market. And probably creates a signal for central Canadian ethanol in the main ethanol producing provinces of Ontario and Quebec to flow west over the Rockies to access the BC market. So our view is it's a bit more of a fuel shuffle on the gasoline side, because Midwest US ethanol can go north to Ontario, and Ontario ethanol flows west through Canada to the BC market. But we're long renewable diesel in Western Canada, especially when the Imperial Oil facility turns on in the second half of this year in Strathcona. So when you include that, plus other producers in BC and Alberta, we're about 1.6 billion liters of installed total capacity. So well within our ability to supply that market. That's a new approach. I don't know if there's any other jurisdictions that have put in place domestic content requirements in the way that they've done it. Arguably, 45Z does have domestic content requirements because it limits eligibility, but this is doing it on the demand side, like on the actual reg T's and C's, than it does via funding mechanism or a carbon intensity score calculation. So it's interesting. I'll say that it's being noticed by other provinces. It represents an approach that can help keep domestic producers operating, because after the BTC sunset, the economic rationale for producing renewable fuels in Canada was injured. This helps that. Is it enough? Our members say it's not enough, but it's certainly something in the right direction, or in a useful direction.
It'll be interesting to see how it plays out, for sure. Seeing that shuffle, and like you said, the different movements pending the arbitrage window for Midwest US ethanol to Canada remains open. You know, depending on the trade situation, you know, who knows where it may escalate.
And just to be really clear, like, this is not saying that US fuels or non-made in Canada fuels can't be used in British Columbia. No, it's just saying that for the 5% and the 8%, those must come from made in Canada fuels. And ultimately, look out over the horizon, it's going to be very difficult to sustain renewable fuel regulations if the domestic industry in Canada is completely cratered. Eventually we say, well, what is the point here? It's undermines the durability of the policies if domestic producers aren't able to access them. This is a move in that direction. Done quite quickly. BC, to their credit, and the low carbon fuel standard team at the government of BC, I mean, they looked at what was happening. They looked at the investments that had been made for renewable diesel production in northern BC, in Prince George, and said, what can we do as regulators to create market conditions that don't strand assets?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. What would you say are ABFC members' biggest concern in the year ahead, you know, in 2025? And maybe what are they most excited about? Like, what's the most promising, exciting thing going on?
This is biofuels. This is renewable fuels. So we all work for pennies. It is a commodity business, right? And so we need stable conditions, stable demand, and for there to be the understanding that policies will endure. Demand is the most important thing in renewable fuel policies. I mean, these are markets that are created by government intervention to state that we need market access for lower carbon fuels. And so governments staying strong and even modifying their programs to make them more appealing for made in Canada and North American renewable fuels is probably one of the more exciting parts. When we meet with provincial and federal bureaucrats, ministers, ministerial office staff, and we state that the market is in a period of flux, a period of change, but where we may end up after this is that Canadian feedstocks can be processed into renewable fuel feedstocks in Canada, turned into renewable fuels in Canada, and be supplied to Canadian renewable fuel policies. We haven't had that before. We've had biodiesel and renewable diesel high-fiving each other as they cross the border because of the BTC. now we don't have that anymore. So we can actually have domestic fuels for domestic markets. And that's a part of energy security. So that is all exciting. There's some very near-term turbulence to get through, but that's what we're going through to get to a place that allows for probably a more longer term sustainable market. Elections are always exciting. We're in the midst of an election right now. April 28th is when Canadians head to the ballot box. Of course, you can vote early now. That's always very interesting. And so with fuels affordability no longer really being the top issue, it creates a bit more space for discussion on what policy looks like from all parties to reduce emissions in the transportation fuel space. So firm policy is always what we're after as an association and what benefits our members. That's what we're busy on. And of course, like I've said probably five times on this podcast already, we have a federal election. During an election process, the civil service usually goes into caretaker mode, which is they don't, active consultations are not happening. So the provinces are very active on what they can potentially do on the renewable fuels files. One of the things that my US colleagues soon become aware of when they pay more attention to Canada is that the provinces have jurisdiction over their energy and environmental policy in a way that US states really don't or don't fully exercise, with some notable exceptions. So there's a lot of opportunity for provinces to do things that benefit investments in their provinces and create markets for renewable fuels. And maybe one last thing, Jordan, that I'm excited about a lot of stuff, is we're seeing way more Canadian cooperation among our provinces. On my street, a lot more Canadian flags being flown in front of houses, which really was not the case. Looking back 2, 3, 4 years, there is a level of enthusiasm for what it means to be Canadian. And there's pretty big differences between the provinces, but there is a very strong sentiment about what it means to be Canadian and working together towards common purpose, especially on energy, traditional and clean, that make it a pretty exciting space to be in right now, and quite a year to be at the helm of an organization. When the board and the membership approved me becoming the president at the start of this year, one of our members said, "Oh, very dynamic times to be taking the helm," and we're living that every second.
Absolutely. I mean, I think uncertainty has pretty much been the theme so far in 2025 for biofuels. I think the more certainty we can get from the way these the election plays out, the policy, once the tax credits, once things kind of finally start to settle down, it'll be really interesting to see the new dynamic, I guess, and how much things have moved around.
Uncertainty. Is that, Jordan, that's why Opus chose to have the Vancouver event in a building with a casino next to it? Pretty nice casino, actually.
All right. Well, yeah, I'm looking forward to being in Vancouver in May, and I hope you all will consider joining us and hear more of Fred's insights. He'll be on stage, and we'll have a lot of other great speakers. So thanks again so much, Fred, for your insights and thoughts. And I look forward to hearing you speak at the event in May.
You got it. Looking forward to it, too. We'll shoot some hoops.
All right. Sounds good. Thanks, Fred.
We hope you've enjoyed today's insider conversation on Opus Talks. Join us next time for a deep dive into another industry insider's world. You can find more Opus Talks episodes at opusnet.com/podcasts or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.